This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Thus have I heard. Once upon a time, in a land far, far away, there lived a person of the Shakya clan who felt trapped by his life and wanted more than anything to just be free. So he found a tree, sat under it, and found the freedom he was looking for, and then started trying to convey it in all different ways, 84,000 different ways, and teaching various categories of experience. And analyze the mind and the world into various lists. That worked quite well for many people. And as people got used to that kind of teaching, the Buddha then, later in his life, began to teach these perfect wisdom sutras, Prajna Paramita. Which taught that all the teachings that he had earlier given, all these lists of mental factors and so on, didn't really even exist the way they seemed to. The perfect wisdom scriptures taught emptiness, that everything is empty of the way you think it is. Everything is empty of itself. Empty of all our ideas, empty of graspability. And the Buddha taught these Prajnaparamita sutras in all different lengths, all teaching emptiness. So the largest was 100,000 lines, the large sutra. Then there was the 25,000 lines, the 18,000 lines, the 10,000 lines, the 8,000 lines, 300 lines, this we call the diamond sutra. And then packing it in more and more densely and concisely and essentially, the Heart Sutra appeared, because it's the heart of the great perfect wisdom sutras. The Hridaya Sutra, the pith core of the Prajnaparamita Sutras in one page. And thus we have this to chant. And became renowned throughout the world as the Heart Sutra. These perfect wisdom sutras began appearing in the world around the year that we call zero, appropriately, because what they taught essentially was zero. And in fact, we're not usually taught this, but I think that the reason why we started counting our years zero was the birth of the Prajnaparamita Sutras. Other religions might say other things. And they evolved over time. I think the 8,000 line version was said to be probably the earliest. And then it got longer and it got shorter, different versions. The one time in Santa Cruz Zen Center, we tried chanting the on New Year's Day, chanting the 8,000 line Prajnaparamita Sutra, but it took I think over 12 hours, so we never did it again. And now I think there, for years after that, we did the 300 line Diamond Sutra as a New Year's celebration. In resonance with the Japanese Zen tradition where, since ancient times up to the present, Zen temples traditionally, chant the large 100,000 line Prajnaparamita Sutra. I was there once in a Japanese temple to do this, and it's, you know, it's long, but the way that you can get through 100,000 lines is each of the priests has a box of 20 or 30 volumes of sutra. And maybe say 10 people have a box that size, like this, of sutra volumes. And that's the whole, I think it's 600 volumes. And the way that you read it is you, in this ritual, you pick up the book and they're these Japanese style accordion style books, right? So the pages are zigzag accordion and you, instead of opening it up to one page at a time, you just kind of fan it out into the air and all the, like a slinky walking down steps. And all the words of the sutra fly off the page and, You can't even see them. They're moving too fast, but you're reciting mantras while the sutra is spread throughout the universe. And that's how the large sutra gets chanted. And then the heart sutra, 50 lines or something, maybe less, seems to actually have appeared a little bit later. The teacher, Xuanzang, an important Chinese translator who went to India and collected these sutras and translated many Prajnaparamita sutras. But there wasn't such thing as a heart sutra, apparently, in India. It's kind of looks like the heart sutra, the one page version we have is extracted from the large, Perfection of Wisdom Sutra by Xuanzang, probably the scholars say these days in the 7th century. And he added a mantra to the end, as you know, and it became kind of like a Dharani or a mantra, a protection sutra, with protective powers, and it's short so you can chant it over and over. You can pack it into a little amulet and carry it with you. All this, so of course, became very well known in all over China and Japan. And when Dogen Zenji began practicing in the 13th century in Japan, of course, he grew up chanting, reciting the Heart Sutra. The heart of great perfect wisdom sutra. And then Dogen went to China, met his teacher, realized the heart of the heart sutra, and then came back and kind of like laid low in Japan for a while. Felt like didn't want to get involved in the politics of Zen. So he was just practicing on his own. He was about 30 years old. And in 1227, not just after Dogen returned from China, he wrote the Fukanza Zengi, the universal instructions for Zazen, and to share with whoever was interested, which were not many people. People had their own practices going on. And then in a couple of years later, he wrote the Bendo Wa, the wholehearted practice of the way, kind of bringing out his style of an understanding of Zen. And then, as I 1231, I think. And then a couple years later, 1233, Dogen wrote this essay, Makahanya Haramitsu. So it was very early in Dogen's writings. And then a couple months after he wrote this, he wrote the Genjo Koan, this wonderful poetic treatise on his understanding, maybe most famous writing of Dogen, the Genjo Koan. So these are the early writings of Dogen. And then he wrote many 95 other chapters of the Shobogenzo. And as the years went by, so this is Dogen, for some reason, Dogen's first writing, amongst his very first writings, is this kind of commentary on the Heart Sutra. Loose commentary, because it's just sort of playing with the lines of the Heart Sutra and adding in other pieces. So he must have felt that the Heart Sutra and Prajnaparamita was very important to Zen. And as we'll see in this essay, the main thing, the main twist that Dogen makes on the Heart Sutra is, instead of saying that all these things are empty, or that they don't exist, but the Heart Sutra says, no eyes, no ears, no nose, no tongue, no body, no mind, and so on. Instead of saying there is none, Dogen says, the eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind are prajna. That's his unique twist. And so we'll get into why he might be doing that and what he means by this. But starting with the title, Shobogenzo is the treasury of the true Dharma eye. And Makahanya Haramitsu is the Japanese way of trying to, seems like, if this is the, was the pronunciation then, trying in not a very like wholehearted way to transliterate the Sanskrit Maha Prajna Paramita. Of course, their sounds are different in Japan, but you can see how it sounds a little bit like Makahanya Haramitsu is a little bit like Maha Prajna Paramita. And that's the standard way Xuanzang transliterated Maha Prajna Paramita. And for some reason, Dogen doesn't put the ta on the end. It's just Makahanya Harami. And it's the same characters, but there's one other that the sutras usually put on the end. Ta. Ta-ta. Why didn't he do that? I don't know. Maybe I could imagine, maybe he felt like, well, I don't want to say that my essay is like a Prajnaparamita sutra. It's almost a Prajnaparamita sutra, but it's one character short of being a scripture. Maybe he thought that. Or like the Enso circle that's like often doesn't quite meet. There's a little gap missing there that really makes the perfect complete circle very beautiful. That little missing gap, maybe the ta for Dogen is like a gap in a Enso circle. Makahanya Haramitsu. just uses the title of the of this collection of sutras. And here we have a translation by Kaz Ta-Nehisi and Ed Brown of San Francisco Zen Center. And, there's many other translations that all have their virtues. There's one by Yasuda Roshi and his Western student Anzan Hoshin. I kind of like their translations. Anzan Hoshin is also a Dzogchen, Tibetan Dzogchen practitioner, which I also practice. So that in the translations, which you can find on the web, of these two, they have a kind of a Dzogchen flavor, I feel like, with all these Dogen translations. For example, the title of their translation is Vast Perfect Knowing. And they use the words like luminosity, kind of thing, more often than Dogen might, or, you know, that the translations, other translators might. There's one by Thomas Cleary, called Great Transcendent Wisdom, in his Little Shobogenzo collection with a kind of introduction that he wrote. There's one by Carl Bielefeld, that's nicely annotated. He's a great scholar. There's one by Heejin Kim, Flowers of Emptiness, also with some nice notes. There's one by Nishijima, Roshi and Shodo Cross. There's one by Shohaku Okamura, translation, and a little commentary, maybe 10 pages, in his Genjo Koan book, Realizing Genjo Koan, which has a little section on this essay, Makahanya Haramitsu. And there's one kind of extensive commentary in English by Kosho Uchiyama Roshi in his kind of a new book called Deepest Practice, Deepest Wisdom. And it's also translated by Shohaku Okamura. And so if you're interested, there are lots of material on this short Dogen essay. So to take a look at the title, Makahanya Haramitsu means, in case you were wondering, Maha Prajna Paramita. A Sanskrit name. And Maha, you know, I think dictionaries would say it means great or big. But Uchiyama Roshi, in his commentary says, Maha, he talks about Maha for like quite a few pages. And he says it means the reality of life or one mind or all. Maybe we could say all inclusiveness, this kind of Maha, not big as opposed to small, but like so vast it transcends dimension. So minute it fits into spacelessness. That kind of Maha. One mind includes everything. The reality of life includes everything. This kind of Maha. And Prajna is really kind of the theme of this whole essay. And a lot could be said about this word Prajna. I think it's interesting to look at Sanskrit etymology. And Sanskrit is this language that has all these cognates with English. It's actually very similar to English language and other European languages. You can find all kinds of examples. Even though the cultures were very different, the languages has similar roots. And so the two parts of prajna, pra and nya. And pra as a, what do you call it, a syllable, a prefix, means higher or supreme or premium or like primary, primo. So you can see the pra is a lot like the English pre. Supreme, premium, primo. I think it's probably a similar root there. And nya is similar to the English word knowledge. So it's, you know, in Sanskrit, it's J-N-A. We would write it that way. And all these words in English that have like K-N. Oh, like knowing, knowledge, G-N-O, like gnosis, prognosis. Prognosis, what is that? When a doctor gives a, is a doctor give a prognosis? Is that like a guess?
Analysis?
Yeah.
What you come down with. Your analysis of the illness.
Right? I wonder, I'm just wondering about the pra, right? It's like prajna, prognosis. It's really similar, but maybe it's the doctor's premium knowledge of your condition. Their best knowledge is their prognosis. I don't know if all the words exactly match up, but maybe. So this nya, is found all throughout because knowing and the mind's illuminating reality is so central to the Buddhist tradition. That there's many common Sanskrit Buddhist terms with nya in them. Like vijnana is consciousness. Jnana means like non-dual awareness. Samnya is the third skanda, like perception or conception. Many words have this nya root. Vijñapti is like a concept. So if you put these two together, pra and nya, maybe we could say like primo knowing. prime knowing, primary knowing. I've never heard it translated that way, but it's valid. I like this word knowing if we are clear that we don't mean like conceptual knowing, in this case of prajna. It's not conceptual knowing, it's not intellectual knowing, but it's like primary knowing. You could say conceptual knowing might be like secondary knowing. It comes after the primary knowing. It's just like the first knowing, the root knowing, knowing or awareness even. Nya is like, can also mean awareness. So prajna is a very rich term. Often it's most commonly translated in English as wisdom. I think wisdom is such a westernized word that I think wisdom maybe often does mean in Western systems more like conceptual wisdom, like the wise old person who has learned a lot of, and they can tell you a lot of what they've learned. But this kind of wisdom is not gradually acquired knowledge. It's not knowledge, right? More like knowing, primary knowing, primo knowing, premium knowing, unleaded, and unadulterated prajna, or understanding is another way that some people translate it. I think that's pretty good. High octane, premium knowing. High octane, yes, for sure. And paramita is kind of like crossing over to the other shore, going beyond, literally something like crossing over the, I don't know if other shore exactly, and I didn't look up the etymology here, so I'm not sure if it's, if the para is the common Sanskrit root that's like, that means other. That would make sense if we're talking about the other shore. Like para tantra is the other dependent nature of things. And then in English, we have like paranormal means like other than normal, maybe. So it could be the same root. And I don't know about Nita's the shore. But so like something about that which crosses us over, that which is crossing over, that which is going beyond or transcending. So the premium knowing that that carries us across to the other shore of freedom from bondage. Maybe that would be a way to translate prajna paramita. Or more concisely, transcendent knowing. I think it's pretty good. Or wisdom beyond wisdom. A funny one because it's like in chanting the title of the sutra, of course, it doesn't have prajna in there twice, but wisdom gone beyond. Great transcendent wisdom. Paramita, when they translate it into Chinese in a one character word, it's the same character that we use for like save. When we say save all beings, it literally means save in Chinese, but it also has this meaning of like to cross over. Beings are numberless, I vow to like carry them over to freedom, something like that is the Chinese term. So maha prajna paramita, and so Uchiyama Roshi's commentary on prajna, yeah, I think he just says like insight or understanding. And Hakuin Zenji in the 1700s wrote a commentary on the Heart Sutra where he goes through the title like this too, and in his very kind of lively and sarcastic kind of style that Hakuin is known for. This is Dogen's maybe most important founder and spokesperson for Soto Zen. Hakuin, although he's quite a few centuries later, is the kind of like Japanese spokesperson, I think, for Rinzai Zen, very important teacher. And his commentary on the word prajna, he says, all people have it with no exceptions. This is the kind of prajna. So if we say it's knowing, it's not the kind of knowing that some people have and others don't have. It's the knowing that all people have without exception. The primary high octane knowing, the unleaded knowing. Yeah. All people have it with no exceptions. It's flawlessly perfect in each one of us, Hakuin says. He, and I think that he means Buddha, who's teaching the Heart Sutra, She plays around making mud pies like this. I think he's saying the Heart Sutra is like a mud pie. And like maybe a kid makes a pie out of mud because it looks like chocolate, but it's kind of fake, right? So this is Hakuin kind of critiquing the Buddha for making a mud pie like the Heart Sutra. Because all people have it with no exceptions. It's flawlessly perfect in each one of us. But Buddha plays around making mud pies, this Heart Sutra. When is he going to stop? This is the way Hakuin often talks. but then kind of the other side of the story here, Hakuin says, but you know, you never actually see it though until your fingers let go from the edge of the cliff. Everyone is fully endowed with it. It's flawlessly perfect in each of us. But we actually never really see it until your fingers let go from the edge of the cliff. That's how we come to really enjoy prajna. That's already here. The knowing that's already here, we're holding on to something for dear life. How can we, like, at the edge of the cliff, how can we let go and drop and not worry about where we'll land? And while we're falling, then Mahaprajna Paramita will be fully revealed. And Hakuin's comment on Paramita, he says, it means to reach the other shore or to cross over. But where is that? Hakuin says, Buddha teaching the sutra is digging himself into a hole to get at the blue sky. He comments the whole kind of sutra sort of in this kind of sarcastic style, but this is just the title. So interesting, and maybe we could say this is what we do too. We dig ourselves into a hole to get at the blue sky. We want to find this vast, unbounded blue sky, but to find it, we kind of dig ourselves into a hole. And maybe here the hole is just the word paramita, and any word for that matter. So that's the title here. And then the essay of Dogen starts off just like the Heart Sutra. It just pulls the Chinese characters right out of the Heart Sutra. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, which, as you may know, we chanted in Japanese, we say Kanji Zai Bodhisattva. And Kanji Zai is also called Kanzeon. So more commonly, really. And I think this is in Uchiyama's commentary. He says early on, like in the 400s, after the year zero, 400 years later, Kumarajiva is this Indian translator who came to China and translated the Indian sutras. It's a hard task, I think, for these very different languages to kind of find just the right words. But according to Uchiyama, Kumarajiva, the translator, was the one to coin the Sino-Japanese term Kanzeon, Chinese Guanshiyin. Guanshiyin Buza is Kumarajiva's way of translating Avalokiteshvara. Guanshiyin means to regard the world sounds. And in Japanese, you pronounce it Kanzeon. And sometimes to abbreviate it, to drop off the world zay, and just say, to regard sounds, the sound regarder, kanon, kanon, guanyin, which means the sound regarder, the meaning she who hears the cries of the world and responds and sees the cries of the world with an eyeball on each of her hands, and then with a wisdom hand, see, the wisdom hand can also like help. That's a beautiful image in the Chinese. I think it started in India, the image of a thousand armed Guan Yin with an eye, a seeing eye in each hand, unifying wisdom eye and compassion hands. So, and then later, so that's Kanzeon, Guan Shuyin. Guan Yin is the one translation of Avalokiteshvara. And then later, which I think that one became more popular in China. It kind of stuck, even though it was earlier, because I think it's pretty nice regarding sounds of the world. Even you could translate it as contemplating the sounds of the world. That guan is also the character they use to translate vipassana. The same word, which means like to contemplate or insight into the sounds of the world. You could translate her name. And, but then Xuanzang in the 600s translated Avalokiteshvara as Kanji Zai, which is more like, it's the same kan, so like regard or contemplate, and Ishvara is like sovereign or like freely acting, like, this is kind of spirit of, he's trying to translate Ishvara with Jizai, is like self-abiding, freely flowing Kanjizai Bodhisattva. Literally, it means, if you were just translated as the three characters, Kanjizai, it's like contemplating self-abiding. But I think as a compound, self-abiding is something, it has this other connotation. It's free to do as one pleases, something like that. But my teacher Tenshin Roshi likes to kind of break it apart into three words, and Uchiyama Roshi was happy to see also kind of like took apart the compound and said it actually literally could be put as regarding or contemplating the way the self abides. Uchiyama Roshi was really into this true self. Kodo Sawaki also talked about true self a lot, so I think he's kind of playing with that etymology of Kanji's eye, contemplating the way the true self abides, just like the way the dude abides.
So this is Ishvara.
Ishvara. Yeah, so Ishvara, you probably wouldn't really translate Ishvara as like self-abiding, but that compound, Jizai, self-abiding, maybe gets at something like Ishvara in Sanskrit is also just used for different gods, like in non-Buddhist, like Hindu Ishvaras. Ishvara, yeah, all these language issues. Avalokite Ishvara, like the god who regards the cries, something like that. So, and we know Avalokiteshvara is the bodhisattva of great compassion. That's her thing. His thing, her thing, their thing. in India, Zen people maybe are sometimes surprised to hear that in India, Avalokiteshvara was always male. And then, and Tibet is usually considered male. But in China, he had a gender change and became generally female. But it's kind of like androgynous, because of course, great compassion doesn't have a gender. But sometimes you see the Chinese images of Guanyin are like this beautiful woman, but she's got a little mustache. If you look close, they're kind of playing with that. So Avalokiteshvara, Bodhisattva, while experiencing deeply the manifestation of Prajna, clearly saw with the entire body that all five skandhas are empty. So this could be translated in many ways, but while experiencing deeply, we usually say deeply practicing, I think this morning's version. Practicing is kind of literal for this Chinese character, gyo, that means like doing, acting, practicing. Shugyo is like Zen practice. So, and interestingly, I think in the Heart Sutra, quite nice that it doesn't say Avalokiteshvara is contemplating or studying Prajnaparamita. She's practicing it. She's deeply practicing it. She's engaged in it deeply, profoundly. And Prajnaparamita, for some reason, this is, I think, the most unusual and radical translation of Prajnaparamita, manifestation of great prajna. Manifestation is causes and ends, translation of paramita, which is definitely not literal translation, but it has a nice nuance. I kind of like it, even though it's academics would say, what? But I think maybe they chose manifestation for this particular essay because all these things are prajna. These five aggregates of prajna, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind are prajna. So if we say they're like these, all the phenomena of the world are manifestations of knowing, that kind of makes more sense. We can maybe relate to it more than saying all these things are prajna. This table is just prajna. It's a kind of a strange idea. We'll get into this more, but if we say this table is a manifestation of knowing, this table is the display of awareness, then maybe we can access what Dogen means here. For whatever reason, they translate paramita as manifestation. It's a little jarring. We can maybe read it as transcendent wisdom also. And clearly saw, that's in the Heart Sutra. But then the Heart Sutra says clearly saw that all five aggregates of skandhas are empty. So Dogen adds in one word here, with the entire body. That part's not in the Heart Sutra. And why does he just throw that in there? I think it's because it's a reference. Dogen does this kind of sort of hidden word plays and references in lots of his writings. It's the same Chinese characters that appear in Dogen's teacher's poem on the next page, which we won't get to for a couple of days. But like about a third of the way down page two, it says, the entire body is a mouth hanging in empty space. That term, konshin, whole body, entire body, is a somewhat, unusual term. And I think that that Dogen is pulling it from that poem of his teacher, Ru Jing, and then putting it up in the beginning of the essay. Uchiyama Roshi doesn't mention that in his commentary. He does mention the whole body, but he doesn't mention it's the same characters as in the poem. So that's my guess. And it has maybe Dogen has this feeling of like, we want to make sure that it's not some conceptual, intellectual exercise here, although it involves concepts and intellect. But this is the entire body. The whole of reality is clearly seeing. That's what's clearly seeing. It's not like our conceptual mind is clearly seeing. The entire body clearly sees that all five skandhas are empty. Uchiyama Roshi's commentary does say about this konshin, whole body. He says whole body means that there's no separation between subject and object. That's pretty good. Well, I think that's a major theme of Zen in general. So this is a clear seeing in which there's no separation between the seer and the seen, subject and the object. That's whole body, clear seeing. And clearly saw, Shouken, which Uchiyama Roshi says, this means self-seeing self. It's almost the same as no separation between self. So this sentence kind of summarizes the whole Heart Sutra, really. It's the rest of the Heart Sutra just kind of expounds on this statement that the Bodhisattva of great compassion, which I think is wonderful, that this Heart Sutra is not taught by the Bodhisattva of great wisdom, Manjushri. That might be more intuitive thing to happen, but it's taught by the Bodhisattva great compassion, deeply practicing premium knowing, clearly saw, in this case with the entire body, that all five aggregates, skandhas, are empty. And the sutra says, and thus relieved all suffering. And you could say that's maybe why it's Avalokiteshvara, because her job description is to relieve all suffering. That's what she does. And in this case, this is how she's doing it, by clearly seeing that all experiences are empty. She relieved all suffering. This is, I like that way of translating it in the, translating the Heart Sutra, because you could say she relieved her suffering, but actually relieved all suffering in her clear seeing of emptiness in this way. She relieved inconceivably the suffering of all beings. It's quite a statement. I mean, this sentence could be contemplated for infinite lifetimes and chewed and swallowed and excreted and planted and harvested and swallow it again for a long time. So, and then Dogen says these five skandhas, and this is, I think, Kaz or Ed Brown saying in parentheses, streams of body and mind. Really, skandha means more like a heap or an aggregate, but it's a nice image of a flowing, changing stream of body and mind. Form, feelings, perceptions, inclinations, and discernment, or consciousness, are fivefold prajna. So each one of them is a kind of knowing. And maybe it's worth briefly mentioning the five aggregates, since this is a major theme of the Heart Sutra, maybe most important list. This is early Buddhist teaching, and you could see it as the Buddhist is trying to describe everything in our experience in terms of five aggregates. There's nothing in our body and mind and the whole world other than the five aggregates. So the Buddha had different kind of descriptions to break down everything, every possible experience into different lists, the Heart Sutra goes through, but this is a good one. Everything we could possibly experience fits into some combination of these five aggregates. And they're taught in this order from kind of gross to subtle, you could say. And a story we could say to kind of integrate them, kind of show how they kind of build on each other, these five aggregates, is like this. The form aggregate, rupa skanda, is often defined as the five sense faculties, the five physical sense faculties, and the five physical sense objects. So in other words, eye, ear, nose, tongue, and body, meaning like the tactility of skin, that aspect of body, just anything about the physical body too. And then the objects of these faculties, so color, sound, smell, taste, and touch or physical sensation. Yeah, so those 10 items are the entire form aggregate. And sometimes, like Vasubandhu would add in like an 11th, like this imperceptible kind of form, but it's too complicated. I think these 10 are a nice way to think, what is form? This is physical stuff, like the so-called physical sense faculty of the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and then the color. This is the world, right? The world is made up of color, sound, smell, taste, and tactility. The physical universe. So that's why we could say the five aggregates really include not just our kind of internal experience, but the entire universe is encompassed in these five aggregates, particularly this form aggregate. So you have these five sense faculties and these five sense objects. And then they seem, in our experience, our dualistic experience, they seem to contact. I say they seem to because Uchiyama Roshi said, right, that the whole body means that there's no separation between the subject and object. But it seems like there's an eye over here and there's a color over on the wall over there. That's called the separation between subject and object. And it seems like that, doesn't it? So whole body means the color on the wall over there is not separate from the eye here. Actually like one reality. That's like profound Prajnaparamita. But it seems like everything's split and divided into subjectivity and objectivity, particularly with the five senses. So when it seems like the eye contacts the color, it's kind of like off-white color of the wall that I'm looking at there. Or the blue of Louise's icon background. So it seems like there's an eye contacting the color, and that's like dualities, two dualistic things seeming to meet. At the moment of that contact, the Buddha taught, there's some really basic kind of sensation. This is the second aggregate. Like sometimes we say feeling, but it's not like an emotional feeling. The second aggregate is more like just the raw sensation of it's only three possibilities: pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. experientially. We look at a color, the eye meets a color, and there's some sense of like, it's slightly pleasant, slightly unpleasant, or it's really pleasant, it's really unpleasant. Or it's neutral, and then I think Vasubandhu maybe says something like, neutral really means slightly unpleasant. Because like almost, yes, that's something you could contemplate. Why would he say that? It's almost like, almost, I almost take it like this, the norm or reality is actually pleasant. You could understand it like that. I mean, the Buddha said nirvana is actually blissful, and nirvana is like reality. So the default reality is kind of like everything's super fine. But like, so if you're like, no, I just feel neutral, kind of like bored with this color. This color. That means I have a little aversion to it. I'm not blissing out with this color. So maybe we say there's just two. There would be another version. There's just two possibilities. When the ear contacts a sound, it's either pleasant or unpleasant.
Could these categories, like pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, could they be like, contain all kinds of subtleties?
I think,
you know, I mean, we might say,
yeah, well, the way we, of course, there's like, you know, extreme unpleasant and subtly unpleasant. So that would be quite different.
Because we don't go through our world saying pleasant, unpleasant, neutral.
Yeah, yeah.
But we have a whole repertoire of assessing how we feel.
Yeah, yeah. You
know? It's really
wrong. Yeah, I think that's right.
I think there's three categories.
So many, I think that's right. There could be many types of pleasant, like from total ecstasy to like, that's a nice color. And those are very different, right? But they're both in this category. Yeah. Well, let's keep going with the other skandhas. Because I think that when we start to assess things, that's where the other skandhas come in. So this is kind of, I think it's interesting if the list is put in this way of kind of most raw, basic, gross, to most subtle and elaborate, you could say, is that before there's any conceptual assessment, even before there's any labeling, I would understand that there's this pleasant or unpleasant. Like we're looking at a color and we're just not even aware of it. And please come on in. Yes, welcome. We're talking about the five aggregates, the five skandhas of experience. And, it's coming. So the nose smells a smell. It seems to be somewhere over there, apart from the nose. And when they contact, there's this raw, basic, preconceptual, like, if it's like, you know, rotten eggs or something, maybe most people are kind of wired to feel it. It's kind of slightly unpleasant. If it's like incense, maybe it's pleasant, but not for everybody. There's no particular thing, but there's pleasant and unpleasant, you know, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, and physical sensations. And then, maybe a moment after that, the third aggregate, skandha, samnya, has that nya root in it, kicks in. And that's like defined usually as the apprehension of the signs of these objects. So it would be like looking at the wall color and thing. It's a little bit like off-white, and where the sun's coming in, it's almost like a little orange. That would be like, maybe without even saying it out loud, we kind of look at something and immediately, like there's a conceptual label. I think this labeling and naming quality is the third aggregate. And I think, and I've understood this from commentaries on this Abhidharma kind of thing, that this labeling comes after the raw sensation, which I wouldn't have intuitively thought that. I would think first your label is like blue, and then it's like, oh, I don't like blue. But according to this story, it's more like we just see direct sensory perception of blue. And then a moment later, it's like, that's blue. And that reminds me that I don't like blue. So this is like, these aggregates are building on each other, right? And starting with the story of the five sense faculties. And maybe we could add in, starting with sensation and feeling, we could add in a sixth. There's a sixth sense in Buddhism. That's the mind and mental objects. So that's not part of the form aggregate. Form aggregate is just physical stuff. But there is a mind that seems to meet objects or have thoughts. And also that's kind of dualistic. It seems like there's my mind and it's giving rise to these thoughts that are something other than the mind that gives rise to them. There's a feeling of duality in our thinking process. We feel like the thoughts are somehow like, or they're coming to us or something. Whereas really it's just one mind. And anyway, we could talk about the mind meeting a mental song could also have a pleasant influence. It does, right? We get to notice all this stuff in Zazen. We can really explore experience, right? There's a lot of Zazen. Just thinking of this thought of some person or some event or something, and it's like, that's unpleasant or that's pleasant. And then this third one, the apprehension of the sign. Oh, that's in the Abhidharma list, they sometimes say like things like blue or long as opposed to short. Or even, I saw this where enemy as opposed to friend, or friend as opposed to enemy. You might say, that's getting pretty conceptually elaborated, but that would still be in this third aggregate category. It's making distinctions. It's discriminating different objects, basically. The third, and this is all happening automatically, right, for all of us, pretty much every moment. And then, based on this apprehension of signs, the fourth aggregate, samskara, is like, in this text is translated as inclination. It's like karmic formations, habitual tendencies. It's all this stuff that doesn't fit into the other aggregates. So like emotional responses, like the classic things like greed, hate, maybe delusion is, maybe that would fit in there too. But like these responses to, or intentions, in response to the sensory experience. So we have the eye sees the color red. There's an unpleasant sensation. That's the second skandha. Then there's a labeling kind of getting a grip on it. Oh, this red color. And then there's like the response of like, actually don't like this. This red is too bright. It's blinding me. I want to turn away. Or, you know, or I eat something and I thought it was a chocolate ball. But wait a second. It's a deer turd. So there's the contact of the tongue and the taste. There's the immediate sensation of it. This is unpleasant. There's then the story of like, tastes like a deer turd. Then there's the like aversion, spit it out, like intention to react to the experience. Impulses. Yeah, I think that'll work. Yeah, I think there's all these different connotations. Impulses, it's like an immediate impulse to either move towards it or get away from it. I think that would be the root impulse. But even things like things like pride and doubt and these mental qualities like this all fit into this fourth area. All these different like qualities of mind. It's kind of that.
There's no conceptualization.
Well, I think the third skanda actually is this labeling, but also conceptualization. Sometimes it's translated as perception. It sounds like just knowing that it's blue, but also the conceptualizing. I think it's translated sometimes as conception. I actually think it maybe makes more sense in the story to look at the third aggregate as conception. So there's sensory contact, direct sensory perception. It's more like the direct sensory perception is kind of in the contact in the first aggregate. Then there's the sensation of pleasant or unpleasant. And then there's conceptualizing about it, which has the range of just directly naming it blue. And then our conceptual elaborations. Like, I never liked blue. And I think it was because like when I was really little, my mom gave me this blue dress and I never liked to wear it or something, you know. You could say, so that's like karmic tendencies are, that's a karmic tendency, right? Like habitual patterns, you know, the translation, habitual patterns, impulses, largely unconscious impulses. Like every time I see blue, it just nauseates me. Right. And then the, but in, again, in regard to these basic building blocks called color, sound, smell, taste, touch. So you can see how the five aggregates build on each other. And then the fifth one, vijnana, so has that nyahu, is like usually translated as consciousness, but it means dualistic consciousness. In other words, this whole story is happening in the realm of duality. Apparent duality where there's these subjective sensors over here and then these objective data out there. That's duality. And vijnana is dualistic knowing. And if you take away the vi, divided knowing. If you take away the vi, divided, and just plain knowing, jnana. Jnana is often translated as non-dual awareness or timeless awareness or primordial knowing. These are some translations. So it's good to keep in mind that the fifth skanda is always kind of like not clear, even though it's just sometimes it's translated as non-discriminating knowing, but it's still dualistic. Non-discriminating knowing. It's just the plain illumination of the other five skandhas, you could say. So in a way, it's not really adding to the story. It's like almost like a background, like awareness of the whole process going on. But this awareness is still dualistic in the sense that it's watching this process that seems to be divided into subject and object. So that's one story about the five aggregates. And so you could see maybe how it includes all experiences of body and mind, which is, and all experiences of the world, any possible human experience or any possible experience of any sentient being, like animals have five aggregates too. So any possible experience can be described is fitting into these five aggregates. In other words, it's an all-inclusive system. There's nothing outside the five aggregates in this model of the Buddha taught. There's not like a sixth possible skanda. If we found it, it would just like, we could put it into one of the other five. And because I think the Buddha taught these all-inclusive models of experience, as kind of like, ways to explore the sense of separate self. That's like when the Buddha first taught these five aggregates, it was in this context. He said, we feel as if there's some me. We feel as if there's some individual, independent self in addition to our changing experience. And the Buddha said, well, if we feel like there is one, let's look for it. Because if we don't find it, we have to look really carefully. And if we don't find it, this will be very good news, the Buddha said. You might think, that sounds terrifying. I wouldn't want to not find myself. The Buddha said, no, this is really great. If you can't find yourself, you'll be very happy. Because, and people sometimes say things like, well, if there's no independent, real me, separate self, then how could I function? It's another part of the story is that the way you function is the five aggregates. They don't need a separate self in addition to the five aggregates. Right? The story we just told of experience happening doesn't need some extra thing called independent me. And the five aggregates are all impermanent, constantly changing, ungraspable, stuff, streams of body and mind. There's no me in addition to them. And I think interestingly, what about the, I often wondered, what about the sense of being a personal self? Like somebody says, Kokyo, and I go, yeah, that's me. They're calling me. Like there's not just five aggregates. It feels like there's some me. The Buddha said, there is that strong sense we all have that there's some core, independent, unchanging, singular me in addition to all this changing stuff. And where is that sense of the separate self fit in? It fits into the fourth aggregate. Sometimes there's this list of all these mental factors like greed, hate, pride, jealousy, doubt, all these kind of like karmic tendencies. And one of the things on the list is the imagination of a separate self. So the imagination of the separate self is part of the five aggregates. Yeah, ego can be used in different ways, but I think it's usually used as like the sense of a separate self and the belief that it's more than just a sense, that it's something, actual real entity. I guess ego could be used both ways. Just the sense of being a person. It's just part of the mental functioning of the mind. And then this kind of unconscious belief that that sense of independent self is a real kind of thing that really is like the essence of individual me. That could be the definition of ego too. So again, the sense of me as an independent person is just a normal thing that I think we're maybe always going to have some sense like that, except maybe like an arhat or a Buddha maybe doesn't even have a sense anymore. But you can be very free and still have some sense, but really don't have to believe it, that it's an actual thing.
In the process of fabricating.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I can see how I'm constructing it. Yeah. Yeah. And it's a mental construction rather than an actual entity. Yeah, an imputation. I can see how the mind is just doing that because it's deeply habituated.
Yeah. There I go again.
And there I go again. Yeah. and then you could say, yeah, the impulse to fabricate a me is in the fourth aggregate. And then the impulse to act on the fabrication is also in the fourth aggregate. You're insulting me. It's just that thought is a mix actually of a bunch of aggregates, right? But, the sense of me and you're insulting me and then and I'm going to get you back. That kind of impulse is that aversion or anger. It's part of the fourth. Meanwhile, there's a consciousness that's watching all that. And meanwhile, the process started when we heard that voice that said, Tokyo, you're a jerk. As the form aggregate started the process, the feeling was unpleasant. The concept of, they just call me a jerk. It's the third aggregate. The impulse of like, now my sense of self is, and my ego sense is getting like stronger. I can feel it building. It feels good. Cause I'm gonna like get it and throw it at them. And then like, I want to throw myself at them. And then the fifth one's kind of like, isn't there going in the right direction? The fifth is just kind of witnessing the whole scene. So the fifth is almost not quite an enlightened witnessing because it's still dualistic, but it's on the right track of it's kind of non-discriminately watching the process of like there, oh, Tokyo, there he goes again. Mm-hmm. He's about to throw his ego at that person. So that's a story for today on the five aggregates. Continue from there in the afternoon. So I think it's a lot to contemplate that first sentence of the Heart Sutra, the first sentence of this essay. Maybe just to mention here that just so we can make it through this first sentence, that it's not just saying that there are five aggregates. That was the story we're just telling. And the early Buddhist teaching is that there's no separate self. There's just these five aggregates and they're all impermanent. But the early teaching is saying there really are these five aggregates. It's just that they're impersonal. There's no self in addition to them. That's a very liberating teaching. It takes one a long way. But then this movement, this Prajnaparamita movement, takes it a step further and says, not only is there no independent personal self in addition to the five aggregates, there aren't even five aggregates, or the five aggregates are empty. It means like they're not what we think they are either. That's this kind of next step of the Heart Sutra. And it goes through, Heart Sutra goes through all these lists of early Buddhism and negates them all. Process, the evolution. Thank you for
listening to this podcast offered by Jikoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jikoji, please visit us on the web at jikoji.org.